Thanks for tuning in to the HR Uprising podcast. I'm your host, Lucinda Carney. The HR Uprising is focused on helping forward-thinking people professionals deliver real lasting value in their organisations. I'm a chartered psychologist, speaker and trainer, and recently authored the best-selling business book, How to Be a Change Superhero. My day job is founder and CEO of software and training business Actus. This gives me the opportunity to work with other businesses like yours. We are focused on building a better workplace for people wherever they are located, with the help of our performance, learning and talent management software and our training and consultancy services. Every week on the podcast, I will be covering different topics and challenges, joined by relevant experts and real-life people professionals. Thank you so much for tuning in. I really hope you enjoy and get value from this week's episode. Hello and welcome to this week's HR Uprising podcast. And this week, I'm delighted to welcome back Dr. Jo Burrell of Ultimate Resilience. She's a co-founder there, and we had her on previously. She works very much with HR professionals in the area of coaching and supervision. But today, what I really want to do is understand more about the fascinating report that you've done on HR wellbeing. So, Jo, would you like to just introduce yourself a little bit?
Thank you so much for having me, Lucinda. It's great to be here. I am Dr. Jo Burrell. I'm a clinical psychologist and also a coach. And I run, as you said, a company called Ultimate Resilience. And we deliver training and coaching to people in order to really build their resilience and help them to overcome burnout and stress.
So you recently ran this. Do you want to tell me a bit about where the origins of this report that you ran?
Sure, yes. So I guess we've been running for 10 years now. And we've met a lot of HR professionals over that time, because HR professionals typically are the people who commission our services. So they come to us and say, we would like, you know, a training course or some coaching for our staff because they're struggling or because they're going through a period of change and we'd like them to develop some resilience skills. And what we found immediately post-pandemic was that there was a shift. So suddenly HR professionals were coming to us asking for something for themselves. So instead of asking something for their staff, they were suddenly coming saying, we would like you to come to our team away day and talk about resilience. We've got some people who are struggling. Maybe you can do some coaching with them. And actually, what I would say about my coaching caseload now is that it's largely made up of HR professionals.
And that's interesting, Jo, because I was thinking that when I think back in terms of the podcast downloads that people have, we did quite a lot on wellbeing, and I often would find that maybe the ones aimed at helping HR professionals would come over as were less frequently downloaded than ones which were aimed at helping others, which gave me the impression that people tend to help others first. That seems to be the default.
Absolutely. And I think that's part of the culture. I mean, I've got to know, I'm obviously not an HR professional myself, but I've got to know the profession very well. We've got some really good, long-standing, close relationships with HR professionals now, having worked in the wellbeing space, workplace wellbeing space for 10 years. And I guess we've had a really unique insight into their experiences and struggles and challenges. And also, you know, I come from a very similar profession, in the sense that all the services that I deliver, that all the work that I've been doing over the last 25 years or so has been about helping others. And so I know absolutely what it's like to be in that role and to be on the receiving end of some of the very difficult things that I know HR professionals deal with. You know, they deliver bad news. They're receiving some very distressing information and material. They're having some really tough conversations. And I know what that's like. And so I guess I became, you know, quite concerned to see this changing trend of people coming to us asking for something for themselves. And I started to wonder, you know, what data is there out there already about the mental well-being of HR professionals? And actually, I discovered not very much. You know, the CIPD have only just started asking questions about mental well-being in their regular report that they do, survey that they do, and they only ask, you know, a couple of questions.
Oh, how interesting. So, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and you know, it seemed to be a very recent focus. And you know, the other thing to say, and someone else mentioned this to me the other day, if you Google HR well-being, What you get is, how can HR help other people's well-being?
Well,
You don't get anything about the well-being of HR people. So I just, I come from a research background. I've got some published research and so on. And so Felicity, my business partner, and I decided, let's do a survey.
yeah.
Let's ask people about their mental well-being. And so we designed a survey, and we included measures of depression, of anxiety, of burnout symptoms. We investigated levels of well-being, and we also asked people about their levels of support at work. So we tried to make it as neat as possible because we know people don't answer long. They're not interested in answering long surveys. So it was only about 10, 15 minutes to complete it. And we sent it out to our subscribers, our email subscribers. We've got quite a lot of HR professionals on that list. And we also put it out, advertised it on LinkedIn. And yes, that's where we're at now. So that we did that at the end of last year. And then we put a report together at the beginning of this year. We consulted, once we had our results together, we consulted some of the thought leaders in the area. So people like Michelle Hartley, we've got Claire Cathcart, Gethin Naidin, Perry Timms. They've all provided their thoughts and insights in the report as well, their comments on, on the findings of the survey.
Yes, it's really easy to read as well, actually, in terms of that. Although I say easy to read in terms of absorbing what it says, I wouldn't say it's easy to read in terms of the fairly scary findings that you've come up with. In terms of the population, how many people did you get responses from?
So we had 91 respondents, which is not a massive number. I mean, I'd really love to do this again. It felt like a bit of an experiment to us. We just try it and see what happens, see who comes back, how many people we get back. And I'd really love to do this again at the end of the year, now that we've done it once and we've had a go and we've seen what happens. So, with that number of respondents, we can't say this is a representative group. We can't say that the responses that we got are wholly representative of the profession, because of course the profession is made up of way, way, way more people than that. But I guess what it's done is it's shone a spotlight. It's highlighted something that I think we all knew was happening, really.
Yeah.
It's just highlighted some people's experiences. And of course, with any survey, it's a self-selecting group. So the people who fill in the survey might well be the ones who are experiencing the worst difficulties. We don't know who chooses. We don't know
Yeah.
what it is that motivates people to choose to fill in a survey. So on that basis, even if we had 2,000 or 5,000 or 6,000 people, we wouldn't necessarily know this was a representative group.
But it's still a
But like,
decent, it is still a decent number, isn't it? It's not what I would kind of say, like a shampoo number, or a face cream number, like nine on a survey of nine people. They 80% of them said it reduced their wrinkles. It's a decent chunk. And I guess what's quite helpful is you being in here for listeners, we'll make sure we put your links in the show notes, because I think if people are on your mailing list, also maybe even the CIPD. In fact, I had a session a couple of weeks ago, the podcast was talking to the CIPD about something entirely different, but wouldn't it be great to extend this, use this as a benchmark, and see, take these findings further through, which people don't know yet what they are.
absolutely. Yes, absolutely. I mean, I would really love to see this because, as I said, this was a bit of an experiment. We just see what happens. And actually, I didn't really know. I had a hunch that the results were going to show something quite concerning. And actually, the reality was the results showed something even more concerning than I thought.
Yes,
So,
yes.
yeah, it was pretty.
Yeah, they are scary findings, I think, as I said to you when we were looking at the questions we were going to discuss. So do you want to give us the highlights, run through those sort of the highlight findings, and we'll perhaps explore some of them and what your thoughts are as to what could be causing these things?
Sure, yes. So what we found was a significantly high number of people experiencing symptoms of depression. So we found 46% of our respondents met the clinical threshold for depression. So these are people that, if I was seeing them as a clinician, because I'm a mental health professional, if I'd administered this questionnaire and they got that score, particularly that they were in that category, I would be definitely thinking about, what do you maybe, what sort of treatment you might need. Probably you're depressed, you're clinically depressed, and you might need some therapy or medication or both, So yeah, 46% of people in that category of clinically significant symptoms of depression And what's interesting is that what we would expect to see in the general population is about 16% of people
Wow.
experiencing clinically significant symptoms of depression. So what we've got is almost three times higher rate of depression amongst the HR professionals who we were surveying than in the general population. And a similar number when it comes to anxiety, about 2.5 times higher levels of clinically significant levels of anxiety compared with the general population.
It's
And
quite
then what?
fascinating. I mean, I say, just in terms of, did you have demographic data in terms of male females and other sorts of things, or age?
Only very minimal, because we wanted to keep the questions the survey as short as possible and as easy to complete as possible. What we
Yes.
know is that about 90% were female, of our respondents were female. And we had a good spread across the age ranges, but I think we had more people in the kind of more experienced end of the spectrum in terms of number of years experience. So about 40, no, yeah, I think in total about 40% of people were in that more experienced end of things.
Yes. Okay. Interesting. So depression and anxiety higher than the general population, significantly higher than the general population,
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
at clinical levels, which is,
Yes.
hopefully people are seeking help in terms of those things. What else did you find?
Absolutely. So we found that 48% are experiencing at least one symptom of burnout. So that's almost half our respondents. And then we found that 57%, so over half, scored in the low well-being range. And then finally, we asked people, do you currently feel supported at work in relation to your mental well-being? And the options were not at all, rarely, somewhat, or very. And only 22% said that they felt very supported. So I guess that indicates that 78% feel that the support that they receive is lacking to some degree. They don't feel fully supported in the
Yes.
workplace. And I guess there's something about that stark difference between the number of people who are struggling and the number of people who feel they're supported at work. There's a big gap there, isn't there? That is a particular concern, I think.
Potentially sort of reinforcing as well, because if you're not getting that support, then those issues, the well-being is going to remain low, and your depression and anxiety may well not recover or become worse.
Absolutely. And actually, many of these people are probably not even telling their employers or their managers that they're struggling.
Yes, absolutely. But what's your thoughts as to why the HR are suffering more than the average person, certainly based on this data?
So I think, I mean, as well as I do, that this is a profession that's faced all manner of demands and pressures and difficulties and challenges over the years, and that there are particular challenges that come with being an HR professional, being in that role. But I think the pandemic, just ramped all of that up massively. I think the HR professionals were like the unsung heroes, the unsung key workers too during the pandemic. When we think about key workers, we think about bus drivers and shop workers and nurses and, healthcare professionals. We don't really think about the role that HR professionals were playing, and they were dealing with so much. There was so much change in the workplace. They were having to implement so many new things and support so many people, and there were so many transitions. I just think that they came out of the pandemic absolutely on their knees, and we're hearing about, the effects on key workers of the pandemic still, that people who were really under pressure during the pandemic, came out of that period feeling exhausted, and actually continued to face lots of challenges in all sorts of services. But we know that HR professionals, that was absolutely the case for them too. So then we've got hybrid working, we've got working from home policies, we've got the cost of living crisis, we've got the Great Resignation, we've got all of these things that they're then having to deal with, so it's just there's been no let up, has there,
And
since
I
the
think during
pandemic.
the pandemic, I just think about things like furloughing. Who'd even heard of the word furlough? And then pretty much overnight, HR had to work out how to have a policy, how to pay people, how to explain it. Those sorts of things were just quite strange, and moving people from office to to working remotely or whatever that might be. It was unprecedented. An HR were having to come up with the answers first with virtually no guidance. And as you say, all
Absolutely.
these things have gone on since.
I spoke to someone the other day who said that when her manager said, right, or CEO of her organization said, right, I need you to sort out the furlough. At that point, she'd heard the word for the first time about 2 hours earlier. So it was like she didn't know.
Yes, exactly. It's weird, isn't it? It's almost like a parallel universe that we've been in. So it's not
Absolutely.
surprising this impact here, but really quite frightening that people haven't been able to bounce back, haven't had the opportunity because of the continued things, like you say, the cost of living crisis and these other things that also continue to, when you're the first port of call in your organisation for others who are suffering, then that's probably where it's becoming difficult. There's no chance to sort of put our own oxygen masks on.
Absolutely. But I think there's also some other underlying factors for me, having got to know lots of HR professionals and, kind of work closely alongside the profession. It feels to me there's a culture that is about, head down and carry on.
Yes,
That's
pick
the
up the bit.
general message. And there's also a culture of, you go to HR for everything. Any sort of problem there is, you go to HR and they'll deal with it. I've heard so many stories from HR professionals where they've said, oh, this manager in my organization, they faced this issue and they just said to someone came along and they had a difficulty and they said, oh, you go and see HR, they'll sort it out. So there's this kind of, it feels to me, an expectation that you will do everything, you'll be everything to everyone, and you'll just suck it up. In fact, I heard the phrase the other day, suck it up, buttercup, which I loved. just take it and absorb it and absorb it and absorb it. And I think that culture, that kind of, I don't know, it's almost like a conspiracy of silence. It's like there's an expectation that you should be superhuman. And because as HR professionals, you receive that expectation, you start to feel like you have to live up to it. And I think it's really hard then to speak out to say, actually, I can't, I'm not superhuman. Actually, I do, there is a limit to my capacity. Actually, I am struggling because there's no, that expectation doesn't, it doesn't exist. There's no one saying, I know you've got limits. So I think there's something about the cultural profession of the profession for me and the way that external forces relate to the profession, which serves as a sort of barrier against people speaking out and accessing support. And I know myself as someone who, has always been in the role of helping others, that it's very hard to pivot round into being the person who's being helped.
Yes.
It's very difficult to do that. And so there's that additional difficulty for people, I think. And then I think there's also the issue that in HR, there's no really clear system of support for HR professionals. There's no one thing that we go, okay, HR does this. We access this particular thing, whether it's mentoring, whether it's coaching, whether it's supervision, whether it's, I don't know, regular, monthly well-being check-ins, whatever it is, there's no clear system where you go right from the start of your career, this is embedded in our profession. We do this, and this is here for us because we know the job's tough. It doesn't exist.
And I think in certain organizations, in a larger organization, HR professionals can lean on each other. But often in an organization where you've got the sort of HR department of one, then really where do you go if you don't go out externally? Or networking's all well and good, but if you don't always have someone in the organization to turn to.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And I've spoken to lots of HR professionals who are in that position who, again, feel there's this weight of expectation on them. And therefore, they feel they can't say to their CEO or whoever it is, I think I might need some support for myself. So it's an incredibly isolated place to be. And actually, what we know is that social support's incredibly important for our well-being. So if you don't have that, then you're already missing one of the key kind of foundations that are going to protect you against, chronic stress and burnout.
And that's what I mean. I've spoken to numbers of people on the podcast about burnout, and one of the things I often find really scary about it is, and it's quite a common story, is people will say, "I thought I was fine, and then it suddenly happened." They didn't really spot any warning signs, and then they just burnt out to the point that they were unable to work at all in terms of those. And I think that is really quite frightening. People really do need to sit up and take this seriously, not just put a brave face on it, because you don't, it's quite hard to come back from it if you push it too far, and you don't always see it coming.
Absolutely. And I guess what you're pointing to is the fact that self-awareness is really, really important. And we talk a lot about that when we're doing our resilience training, we're doing coaching with people, we're talking to people about stress, that actually, having that self-awareness, what are my early warning signs of stress? What
What
would
do
I
you say they
notice about?
are, Joe? Actually, it was just interesting, wasn't it? As I was talking to you as we came on, saying that I've trapped a nerve in my neck. And I've just been to the physio today, and she was saying, "Can you feel like can you relax? Can you relax?" I thought I am relaxed. Not really. This is just kind of how my neck is. Which those sorts of things you're not without aware of. And asking myself the same question: what would you tell listeners to listen out for, or to watch out for it themselves?
Absolutely. So, early warning signs of stress, as we're going about day to day, we're doing our jobs or whatever it is, sighing, yawning, and gasping. These are signs that we're over breathing, tension in the body. That's what you're referring to. Slightly feeling slightly agitated, maybe a bit unsettled in the stomach. Maybe you're starting to feel a bit, I don't know, a bit hot and sweaty. These are all early warning signs that we tend to ignore. We sort of subtly notice them. They're subtle signs. We sort of notice them and we go, oh, it's all right, I'll just push on. But actually, they're really important signs, because if we can intervene at that point. And it might be just doing, a 5-minute breathing exercise. It might be just getting up and having a stretch, or going and making a cup of tea. It might be all we need to do is that small thing that helps to just bring that stress level back down again and stops it from starting to mount up. Because, of course, when we ignore it, then it starts to mount up and mount up and mount up. But I think day to day, as stress is starting to become chronic and we're dealing with day to day pressures and demands and difficulties, then obviously things like poor sleep, as a really, a very common sign. We're not, we're get having difficulty getting off to sleep or waking in the night, or both
Did
struggle,
you say, in fact, that's one of your findings, isn't it? That 74% had trouble falling or staying asleep or sleeping too much.
So absolutely. I mean, sometimes these signs of anxiety and depression can be opposite. We can undereat or overeat. We can undersleep or oversleep. So we're looking out for all of these different sorts of signs. I think often we start to get a bit more withdrawn, maybe when we're overstressed. We start to stop doing the things that we love to do, the hobbies, spending time with loved ones, those sorts of things. So it's really important to notice that when we're doing that. And of course, there are lots of physiological signs of stress, aren't there? That churning stomach, that, racing heart rate, those sorts of things. If we're starting to feel that, I don't know, often when chronic stress is setting in, we're feeling sort of agitated a lot and unsettled in ourselves a lot. So just noticing that is really, really important.
And yes, not letting it be normal. So it's normalizing it is the problem, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that is what, and I think actually being calm becomes not normal. It becomes sort of slightly unnerving. They talk, you probably hear people talking about doing versus being. We spend a lot of time doing, don't we? And not enough time just being. And particularly in today's culture, when we're just bombarded with lots of stuff and there's technology and, social media and screens and all that sort of stuff happening all the time, being becomes very unfamiliar to us. And so when we try to do it, we want to go back to be it, to doing, sorry, almost immediately, because it feels strange. It feels too weird, but actually it's really, really important that we spend time just being, just listening to music, maybe having a bath, maybe sitting in the garden, listening to the birds or the cars. In my case, I live quite near a main road, but it doesn't matter to just sit and listen. Maybe have a 5-minute walk and just notice what you see. Just a few minutes is enough to help us to calm.
And so that's moving into the things that we can practically do then if we want to prevent burnout, if we want to boost our well-being. So one of them would be just being, but learning to be, which is not even as, in that example you're using, isn't as even as complex as doing a meditation or something. It's actually just, you know, noticing your surroundings and being in yourself for a while rather than doing. What other tips have you got?
Absolutely. And I think we really like to teach people simple tips because everyone's busy and there's very little space to fit things in. So it's really important that people have things that they can use and that are going to work in a very short space of time. I think one of the things that we want to be doing is really noticing any overly negative patterns of thinking, because the more stressed we get, the more we can start to think in negative ways. And also, I guess what I know about HR professionals is that they are often very passionate about what they do. They care a lot about what they do. They have very high standards. And when we have high standards, we can beat ourselves up a lot. We can say, I should never make mistakes. And if I did, that was really terrible of me. How embarrassing. What an idiot I am. How stupid I am that I did that. And, you know, we're human beings at the end of the day. We all make mistakes. We're never perfect. We're never going to be perfect. We might do things well, but, you know, at times, but other times we're not doing things so well. So noticing when we're talking to ourselves in negative ways is really important. And just taking a moment, you know, is that really true? When I say to myself, I'm always making mistakes, is that really true? Or is that an overly negative perspective? Because
yes, it's almost like, would you be like that to someone else? It's almost, are you being, is your self-talk meaner than it would be that you'd speak to someone else?
Absolutely. And generally speaking, when I ask people that question, they say, no, I would never talk to anyone else like that. So we are so hard on ourselves, so harsh on ourselves. And sometimes just taking that moment to notice that we're thinking that way and to have that, you know, just ask ourselves, would I say that to someone else? Or what would I say to a friend who was saying, I'm always making mistakes. What would I say to them? What I would probably say is, well, you know, you didn't make a mistake when you did that really well. I remember when you told me about X and you did that really well. You know, you would highlight all the positives, the exceptions to that overly negative thought. I think one of the problems is that those thoughts come fleetingly into our minds and they affect how we feel. They make us feel stress, but we don't even necessarily notice that they're there. So it's really important to just take a few moments sometimes. You know, maybe if you start to feel stressed, to think, what was I thinking?
That's interesting. Correcting your negative thinking. That's a really interesting, what is that self-talk going on? Are you beating yourself up? Because you are, if you are speaking to yourself internally in a way that you wouldn't speak to others, then how interesting, you're basically unconsciously, you know, creating stress for yourself, or, you know, taking yourself down, taking away your resilience, I suppose, aren't you?
Undermining your resilience, absolutely. Yeah. And that's why when we do our resilience training and when we do coaching with people, this is one of the skills that we help people to develop, is to combat that overly negative, you know, pattern, those overly negative patterns of thinking. And absolutely, as you say, what it can lead you into is a vicious cycle. So if I have an overly negative thought about myself, I criticize myself, I feel anxious, I start to get physiological symptoms of stress, perhaps, as you know, stomach churns, I might do things, I might behave in ways that I wouldn't normally want to behave. You know, I might get a bit agitated with people, or I might walk out of a meeting suddenly, or I, you know, I might do something that actually is not really in line with my values or the way I want to be. And then that leads me back into being self-critical again. Oh, I left that meeting early because I was, you know, I was feeling stressed. Oh, I feel really bad that I wasn't there. People noticed that I left that meeting early, you know, and then I go back into criticizing myself. So there's a vicious cycle that can go on that's triggered by us perceiving ourselves in an overly negative way.
Yeah. So we're saying basically we need to make time for be in the present, be kind to ourselves and notice our sort of self-talk to make sure we're not undermining our resilience and supporting ourselves better in that way. What other sort of tips have you got?
So I think there's something about us all setting an example. So one of the things that I hear a lot from HR professionals, but also from other people professionals, is it's really you know, it's easy to help other people and their well-being, to support other people's well-being, to encourage other people to look after themselves. But it's not very easy to look after myself, to prioritize my own well-being. And I guess one of the things I think it's really important to remember is if you are prioritizing your well-being, then you're setting an example to other people. So just in acting that way, you are showing them, encouraging them to do it too. And maybe, if we think of it as a less, as a more selfless act, maybe
Yes.
that's helpful. But I
Role
think
modeling, basically. Yes, that is a really valid
exactly.
point. If you're and also if you're
Exactly.
a leader of an organization, you need to role model it, absolutely.
Totally. I was going to move on and say exactly that, that if you're in a leadership position, it's particularly important that you do that. Because if you're not role modeling good well-being behaviors, then your staff don't feel they have permission to do it either. If what you're doing is working excessive hours and never going on annual leave and never taking a break and, sending emails in the middle of the night, that's what your staff think they should be doing as well.
Yes. Yes.
So it's really important that if you're in a leadership position, that you are not only modeling those practices, but also talking about, you don't have to, you set your own boundaries around what you're happy to reveal, to disclose, but talking about the sorts of help that you might access, that people are accessing, that you would consider accessing, that you have accessed, so that you're normalizing it. Because I think sometimes it's hard to say, oh yeah, I've been to counseling. Because it feels like somehow it's a weakness. I was struggling so difficultly, so much that I had to reach out. But actually, it's really great if you can say, as a manager or a leader, this is something I've utilized, because we're human beings and sometimes life's difficult and we just have to do that. We have to reach out.
And it's
But
helpful,
I
isn't it?
think
And
this.
especially if it's helped you as well, because that might inspire somebody else.
Totally. And so this is, I think, it's also all about like just opening up the conversation. I was talking earlier about how I really think there's a conspiracy of silence. And just talking about it, talking about our mental well-being, talking about how our job impacts our mental well-being, talking about, what steps we can take, just having that regular conversation, and whether you build it into your regular meeting team meetings, or whether, if you're a lone HR, you bandy together with a friend who's also in HR and you have the conversations outside of work. Just making sure you're having regular conversations about well-being, because I think there's a real stigma for people who work in HR. They feel like they can't put their hand up and say, I'm struggling. So the more we talk, the more likely it is that people are going to reach out. They're going to say, I need something. They're going to and actually support each other.
Yes.
You don't know I'm struggling unless I tell you. So you can't do anything about it unless I tell you something about what's going on for me.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is how we sort of challenge this culture where it's sort of under the surface in terms of being prepared to talk about it, being prepared to role model it, and talk to others, just make it safe to have these sort of conversations about your own mental health and leading the way in terms of that potentially.
Absolutely. And it's really fine to just say to someone, I'm a bit concerned about you too. So it might be that you're opening up a conversation with someone that you think is struggling. It's really fine to say, I'm a bit concerned about you. Are you okay? Because
Yes.
you can follow that up with, you don't need to tell me anything. It's fine. If you're not comfortable to talk to me, that's not a problem at all. But just saying to someone, I've noticed that you're not yourself lately, or something like that, gives the person the opportunity to say, actually, yeah, I am struggling. And you might not have all the answers, and that's fine too. You can say, I might not have all the answers, but just sometimes just listening is the most valuable thing you can do. I think we undervalue the role that listening has. And
Yeah.
actually, I can think of loads of times in my life when someone's just made the space for me to go blah,
Yes.
to just offload, and how helpful that's been, that they've just sat and listened.
So it's not about
So
fixing. Sometimes just feeling heard is really helpful for people. And of course, often HR do that for other people. So and
yeah.
that's, I mean, that's an interesting slight segue, which perhaps for another day, where we talked about when on the previous podcast, where we talked about where you might coach people, support people. It's quite easy for us just to take it on board. And if you are, you're obviously a clinical psychologist, you would have formal ways of letting go if you've heard other people's problems, you would have more formal ways of releasing it. I don't think that exists really for HR. So maybe making the opportunity to, let go of those problems, listening to them
Yes.
in itself is a good thing to have done.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And I guess that's what I was you referring to when I was saying earlier that I think there aren't the kind of systems of support embedded in HR. And actually, I think that's what's really needed because HR professionals are hearing some hideously difficult things.
Yes.
They're on the receiving end of some hideously difficult things. And there's nothing, you know, there's no, okay, this is a recognized place where I can go and talk about this or where I can get some support or help or there's nothing across HR, it seems to me, that comes as standard. This, you know, this is embedded in our profession.
So I think really you very helpfully sort of challenged, talked about how we can challenge the narrative. We talk about how we can role model, we can talk about it, we can be present or reflect, we can try and seek out support and support each other. Are there any other tips or practical tips you've got for listeners, that come out of this report that you would recommend people think about doing?
Sure. Something comes to mind. I had a conversation yesterday. I was at the NEC in Birmingham at the Health and Wellbeing in Work event, and we were there talking a bit about our report and burnout and those sorts of things. And I had a conversation with an HR professional, and she said, "Oh, we've got coaching in our organisation, and my manager has encouraged me to access it, but I just think, oh." You know, it's someone else probably deserves it more than I do, or I should leave that space open for someone else. So it made me think, you know, there's something about always putting yourself at the back of the queue. So even when there is provision available, often HR professionals are saying, oh, that's not really for me, that's for someone else. So just not putting yourself at the back of the queue is one of my pieces of advice,
It's kind of
saying to a
investing,
customer,
thinking about it as actually, it's almost boost your batteries up front because you never know. It's almost recharge before you know you need to, because you never know when you're not going to have the opportunity to, as opposed to wait until you're really low on energy, and then you might run out. So it's having that proactive approach.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that's crucial, really. And I think that's, you know, the lack of that is why we're at the place where we're at now in terms of the sort of high levels of, you know, mental distress that we're seeing amongst HR professionals because people haven't been doing that through no fault of their own, because I think there's a there are huge pressures. And there isn't the encouragement there for people to be accessing, you know, support and help. And I think there, you know, in the modern workplace, there isn't the encouragement for any of us, or that it's there for very few of us to be putting down clear boundaries around work. You know, modern technology means that work is on, it's always on. I
Yes.
can be looking at my emails at midnight. I can, you know, I could be scheduling it. I could be writing an email and scheduling it for the morning, make it look like I'm not even at work. And, you know, I can be doing all sorts of things that are work related outside of work. And so those boundaries are really blurred now. It used to be easy because we finished, we clocked off at 5 o'clock, we went home, there were no reminders of work. So there was this clear free space where we could recover, relax, recuperate, do things that weren't work related, engage in hobbies, be with our loved ones. All of these things are really good for our well-being. Now it's so blurred, it's very difficult to switch off from work. So I guess one of my other tips would be to be trying to think about how can I lay down boundaries, both within work and outside of work, you know, taking regular breaks, even if it's 5 minutes. Just making sure, noticing those early warning signs of stress and taking a 5 minute break, if that's what all you can take. But, you know, so taking regular breaks, making sure you finish at a decent time, not working 25 hours a day, booking your annual leave in if you work for an employer well in advance, so you know you've got time coming up. You know, all of that around just, yeah, setting down boundaries, trying to be assertive sometimes. Sometimes you just have to say no to
And maybe things
things.
like prioritizing your hobbies or something, because I think it's quite typical. Let's say someone has a yoga class they'd like to get to, but it's easy to go, oh, I won't make it today because I'm having to do this thing at work. Maybe giving those equal priority, in terms of those things that you're doing that are renewal activities for yourself.
Yes, totally. And we know that these are the things that drop off first when people are stressed and overwhelmed. And actually, they're the things that's exactly the time when you need them.
Yes, so
Because
keep
we
them.
know that actually, the things you love to do, your hobbies, your interests, the things that really, you know, engage you, that they build your resilience. They're also linked with lots of positive emotions, which are really good for your well-being too and your resilience too. You know, when we have opportunities to experience positive emotions, whether that's love or amusement or gratitude, that boosts our resilience, and it stimulates the parasympathetic nervous system, which helps us to feel calm and safe.
So again, that's priorities of things with other people, isn't it? Then, so if you have a hobby that you spend with other people, which you love doing, or a family activity, then those really shouldn't be sacrificed in the name of work. If you find ways of fitting those in.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. And one final thing I was going to say on the back of the report is, and it's interesting because I did a poll on LinkedIn in this past week asking HR professionals, what's the one thing that would improve your mental well-being at work? And 31%, and obviously you're forced into options. So I had reduced workload. I mean, that's obvious, isn't it?
Yeah.
More support and increased recognition. And 40% said workload. So that came out on top, but actually increased recognition was 31%. And I was quite surprised by that. You know, it was a close second. I thought reduced workload would come out massively on top. And in fact, I had someone message me saying, I know what the answer is going to be to this poll already. It's going to be workload.
Yeah.
And in fact, at certain points during the week, more recognition was on top, you know, quite a number of times through the week. So there's something about that value and recognition which is really missing for people. And we know that if you feel valued at work, that has positive benefits for your mental well-being.
That is interesting. And also, I mean, there's quite a lot in that. That's quite a deep question in its own right in terms of feeling valued, because there is something about if HR isn't valued in the work, in the environment you're working, maybe go and work somewhere else. If you can, you know, go somewhere where you are appreciated. If you are a leader, or what can you do for leaders to value what you do? But equally, maybe some of the responsibility is with us, because if we put ourselves second and don't value and don't stand up for ourselves, then people don't respect you back. So it's kind of three-pronged or multi-pronged, isn't it, in terms of that? Stand up for ourselves, let's be assertive, let's us value ourselves, if it's not coming our way necessarily.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that goes back to those expectations that I was talking about earlier. I think others expect something of us, and then we start to expect it ourselves. Yeah. And then, of course, there's this kind of silence, a veil of silence that comes down, and no one's speaking up. And I think to counteract this trend, this really worrying trend that seems to be emerging. Well, it's emerged, it seems to me, you know, we need to be speaking out. We need to be saying, I have needs here.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, we're reaching the end of our time together, but I think it's almost a question to throw out for the audience. So why aren't we valued? Is it that what we do isn't seen? Are we not sharing what's being done? Is it not, it's just kind of happening behind the scenes? It's very much, you know, the book Invisible Women. Is it very much, you know, 90% of your response were women? Because a lot of these people will also be holding up a home environment as well without complaining, sort of thing. So this huge pressure, but how the fact that the deliverables, the things that are happening on a regular basis, are just not appreciated. Why is that? Is that because the line manager, whoever that leader is, doesn't see it? Why? Well, what can we do about that? Because other parts, other leadership, other roles wouldn't put up with it. You know, that's the thing. Or is it cultural? And if it is cultural, you've got a culture where there's lack of feedback, there's lack of recognition, then sort it out, because that will be affecting everybody's engagement, right? And everybody's well-being in your organisation. So interesting. Yeah, Jo, fascinating. If people want to download the reports themselves, sign up, obviously get on your mailing list so they could take part in your next one as well. I think that's so interesting as well, wouldn't it? We see how things go. You should do it on a regular basis, see how things go over time. I'm happy to get hold of you.
So ultimateresilience.co.uk, on our homepage, you will see a link to the report. So you can just click on there and you can download the report from there. And obviously you can see the services that we're providing. We're working lots with HR professionals now. My case, you know, I think I might have said earlier, my caseload is, you know, largely filled by HR professionals now for coaching. So you can have a look at our services. And I'm on LinkedIn, Dr. Jo Burrell. So do connect with me and you know, join my conversation, because this is something that I'll be continuing to talk about.
Absolutely. Take part in your polls. Get yourself heard as well.
Yes.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me today, Jo. That was a fascinating conversation.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I hope that's inspired everybody to have some downtime over the next few weeks. And HR Uprising is also going to take a little break during April and over Easter. So we look forward to catching up with you towards the summer. I really hope you found this week's episode useful and enjoyable. If you did, perhaps you could recommend us to a friend or colleague, or give us a review on your platform of choice. It really helps new listeners to find us. Now, you can access links to any of the information mentioned in this show via the website www.hruprising.com. Further free resources are also available at www.actus.co.uk. There you can also find out more about our software and training solutions. Finally, why not join our LinkedIn group, The HR Uprising, to share ideas and collaborate with other like-minded people professionals. Thank you for listening to the HR Uprising podcast.